I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. In 2004, PBS aired a landmark miniseries documentary, Broadway, the American Musical. It was from the filmmaker Michael Kantor, who joins me now, who wrote the film and the companion book with Lawrence Maslin. The book, a comprehensive resource on its own, has just had its third edition published, updated through to the 2018-19 season. It features the Book of Mormon, Hamilton, Dear Evan Hansen, and last year's winner of the Tony for Best Musical, Hadestown. The book has been lauded as the gold standard when it comes to musical theater books for how it chronicles the evolution of the art form from the turn of the 20th century and its roots in operetta and Yiddish theater through to its golden era mid-century, through to the new millennium. The place and the idea of Broadway is contemplated throughout the book, and features remarkable steals from the history of the Great White Way with interviews with people at the heart of Broadway and the musical, the performers, the creators and composers, the audience, and everyone in between. Michael Kantor is an award-winning writer, director, and producer. Broadway the American Musical won an Emmy for Outstanding Nonfiction Series, and his other work, like Make 'Em Laugh, The Funny Business of America, was Emmy-nominated. And Broadway Musicals, A Jewish Legacy, and other remarkable series for PBS's great performances, received a Peabody Award. In 2014, he became executive producer of the American Masters series on PBS, overseeing films such as Bombshell, The Hedy Lamarr Story, Raul Julia, The World's a Stage, and the recent Sammy Davis Jr., I've Gotta Be Me. He is also a nominator for the Tony Awards. The new edition is from Applause Books and is available now. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, Michael Kantor. Mr. Kantor, good morning.
Hi.
Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
So this idea of whether the Broadway musical, I mean, is that a question that's still being asked? Because I read things in the paper about Broadway attendance being at an all-time high year after year. It seems that, reading the book, there have been valleys, you know, throughout the last century or so, but, I mean, is the future of Broadway still in doubt, say?
Well, I think, you know, I remember interviewing Al Hirschfeld, the great illustrator, who I believe for the documentary Broadway the American Musical, I interviewed two or three times, and he loved to refer to Broadway as the fabulous invalid, and I haven't given any thought to it, but I think you could easily change that nickname to the fabulously wealthy invalid, because when you look at the amount of revenue that shows are generating and the ticket prices and so on, this is not no longer a kind of fly-by-the-seat-of-your-pants industry. I mean, we're talking about billions of dollars that a given show can gross. And every season, the Broadway ticket revenue is in the billions. And some time back at the last strike, you realize how much of New York's economy is driven by the fact that there are shows in these 30-some theaters every night, and the restaurants and the hotel rooms and so on. So I think it's here to stay. Where the Broadway musical is heading is a different question, but
right.
I don't think we're in any precarious mode right now.
A lot of people might think of New York City as a sports city, you know, with all the various sports teams and the sort, but the revenue for Broadway overshadows that, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think Jerry Schoenfeld, who now has a Broadway theater named after him but was head of the Schubert Organization, said in an interview with us that the Broadway, the more people buy tickets to Broadway shows than all of the New York City or New York sports teams combined.
Right.
So I think, you know, it's a huge part of driving New York City's economy.
Now, you alluded to a moment ago the price of tickets on Broadway. I was going to say that it's prohibitive for a lot of people. And considering historically, a lot of people were able to, you know, get in for, you know, 50 cents or over the years, $10. And you know, now we're up to $100, say, a ticket on average. Then talking about sports a moment ago, tickets to sporting events, I mean, they're not cheap either, are they?
No. I mean, I took my son to see a New York Knicks game, and it was more expensive than a Broadway ticket, and the Knicks stink. So that's one way to look at it. I think Jerry Orbach, I keep sort of quoting the people that I spoke to about this history, but they have, you know, Schoenfeld and Orbach being dead, their history goes much farther back than I ever conceived of. Orbach pointed out that historically there's a pretty strong correlation between a Broadway ticket and a movie ticket, that a movie ticket would cost X, uh-huh, and Broadway would be 10X. So movie tickets are now $13, $16, and Broadway tickets are $130 and $160.
Right.
And if you go back to the days of Florenz Ziegfeld, it was always that way, and in the 50s, too. I remember Walter Matthau, who I interviewed, not for this, but when he got started in New York, he actually started in the Yiddish theater.
Mm-hmm.
He would see movies, and you could go on a Sunday and see two movies for 5 cents in the Depression. Well, you know, you could never see a Broadway show for a nickel. I mean,
yeah.
The Ziegfeld Follies shows, I think, were $2.50, so that was a lot. So I think they are expensive, but I think what's changed and what is evident in the last portion of our third edition of Broadway, the American Musical, the book that my writing partner Larry Maslon updated, is that there's now so many sources of discounted tickets and ways to get tickets that, yes, there's VIP pricing, so that if you want to sit, you know, fifth row center or on the aisle on a show like Hamilton or, you know, formerly The Producers, you're going to pay a ton of money, just like if you wanted to go to the Super Bowl, as you mentioned, or some, you know, Beyonce concert, it's going to be extremely expensive. But at the same time, there's lotteries and wait lists and so on that are really reasonable. And so if you're committed to seeing a show, you can find a way to get in.
Now, in updating the book, Broadway, the American Musical, this is the third edition. What did you want to, say, chronicle as to where the musical has evolved since, say, the film and the first edition came out?
Well, the hardest thing in any kind of historical undertaking, like a documentary film series or a historical purview in terms of a book, is the very last chapter, the last moment, because you know, things change, and it's much easier to tell a story about, say, a historical figure who's died,
mm-hmm,
because their story ends and you can chart their legacy, as opposed to something like a living art form like the Broadway musical. So we're wrestling with, you know, contemporary themes and trends and trying to put the best, you know, crystal ball in terms of how significant those trends are. And I think, by and large, what I've realized is the documentary in the first book came out in 2004. And every 15 years or so in the documentary was a new episode, a new chapter, you know, roughly. I think some episodes were a decade. So things change, and you hope to put them in perspective. And we just want to make sure that, say, a student who read the book in 2004 and who's now a grown-up,
yeah,
who, if they were in high school then, they might have two kids now, that they feel as connected, that they want to, if they don't live in New York or come to New York, that they know who the new stars are, that they feel connected to where Broadway's going. So I think it makes perfect sense. Also, there's been a great demand for the book, not simply as a nice coffee table book with 500 illustrations, but as a teaching text. And, pardon me, I think we've done a good job of putting contemporary shows and trends in historical perspective in terms of how, you know, a star vehicle now reflects a star vehicle from the 20s and, you know, the way the source material has changed from, say, books and plays to now the use of movies and so forth. So I think for students of the Broadway musical, it's become even more valuable.
I remember when I saw the, I guess I saw the film first on PBS before I bought the book back in 2004. And I remember when I read the book then, and then I reread it recently for this third edition, thinking to myself, it really is a companion to the film, isn't it? I mean, it's all, if you have both the film and the book.
You're covered.
You really are, aren't you?
Well, you know, nowadays, anyone who works in media, in any portion of media, and I guess I would include theater in that broad description of, or entertainment, you want to be platform specific, right? So a podcast is going to be different from a television show, is going to be different from something, say, a feature documentary you'd see in a movie theater, etc. And I think it's great that in the documentary you could see Ethel Merman singing and hear her, but by virtue of the fact that it's a documentary and it's time to, in the case of this documentary, 6 hours, there's so much that's left out. And the book will live on with lots of stories that never made it into the documentary.
Right.
Lots of characters who, for one reason or another, we couldn't include, and it's, so it's just much more expansive, much more comprehensive.
Yeah. Well, was there an era of Broadway's history that you enjoyed researching the most?
I'm most fond of, maybe we're headed that way right now, the Depression era of the 30s. I'm just joking, obviously, about our economy. But the 30s, pardon me, to my mind, are such an interesting mix of socially relevant satires and spoofs and, you know, songs that are produced like Brother, Can You Spare a Dime? And total escapist Fred Astaire-style shows where the plot doesn't really make much of a difference, the Rodgers and Hart vehicles, but in which, you know, this incredible music is embedded, and it was just such an amazing era where stars like Gene Kelly get their start, and Cole Porter is really, to my mind, reshaping American norms through songs like Let's Do It. Actually, that's right at the turn of the Depression, but, you know, his, I'd say, the great majority of his material is right in the midst of the Depression. So, I don't know, it's just because of that polarity, I guess, or bipolar nature of that era, I just find it really interesting. There's still great reviews that stars like Ethel Waters participate in, and I don't know. That's kind of my favorite, I guess.
Yeah. The fascinating part about the book and the film, you profile these larger-than-life characters like Florin Ziegfeld and David Merrick. These are guys that are characters in themselves, or they're myths even, and the importance of these producers. I mean, and then we think of Bialystok from the producers that send up. They have been important to the mythos of Broadway, haven't they?
Yeah, there's no question that a book can detail the stories of these movers and shakers, these producers, who may well have been more important to the history of the Broadway musical than any given performer, and do it in a way that, you know, it's tough because they're not in front of the footlights or recording a song in a documentary. But from the outset, I think we recognized, you know, Florin Ziegfeld's importance, not just in terms of the Follies, but in producing Showboat in 1927. It just can't be underestimated. And it's interesting now that with the cost of production being as high as it is, that there's very few people, maybe Scott Rudin is principally a play producer, but who take on the burden and the challenge of producing a big show for Broadway. Now it's huge teams of dozens of producers, all of whom are chipping in. But you don't get the strong hand that a David Merrick or Hal Prince in his day as a producer, or Ziegfeld had.
Or Mr. Abbott.
Yeah, it's just different. Again, back in the 30s, Rodgers and Hart would put on two shows on Broadway a year. They didn't run for very long, but people were cranking out shows, and now the length of the runs and the cost make everything much more complicated and fraught with risk.
Yeah. So did you ever meet David Merrick?
Never did. I met a lot of people who worked with him. I never got a chance to go in his red office. Apparently his office was bright red, or red covered sofas and everything. But no, never did. Howard Kissel wrote a great book on him.
Yeah.
And a lot of people who worked with him we were able to talk to, but sorry to have missed him.
I mean, that's the other thing I was thinking about. I was reading the book and watching the film. Were there people, I mean, there are a lot of people, obviously, that had died by the early 2000s when you were producing this. But were there people that were still around that you didn't get to interview but you wanted?
You know, I think that was a great foundation for both the documentary and the book. Was we were there at the right time. The whole enterprise came about because I was in New York in the early 90s and was in a taxi coming through Times Square. I'd lived here since the mid-80s.
Uh-huh.
And I looked around and I was thinking of a new documentary series, and in keeping with that idea of it's much harder to do something that doesn't have an ending, a contemporary story, I thought, well, what's a great story that has an ending? Well, what's dead? Who's dead?
Mm.
And I was driving through Times Square, and I said, Broadway's dead. And this was before, before Disney revamped the New Amsterdam. And, it was still pretty rough in the early 90s. And so when we went and reached out to both everybody in the Broadway community, from theater owners to ex-stars, they're just, there was no internet where people wanted to do a social media post with everybody, and I don't know. It really felt like a smaller community. I'm sure, to quote Paul Gallo, the great lighting designer, there's only 180 people who work in theater at any given moment, and they just keep rotating around. I'm sure that's still the case.
Yeah. That
there's a core group of people who are always working, and then, but I think the access to those people has changed, and it was relatively, again, I came from a Ken Burns PBS background, and I kind of flagged that, saying, I just worked with Ken, and now we're turning that kind of rigorous, meticulously crafted type of documentary filmmaking to this all-American art form, a uniquely American form of the Broadway musical, and we want you to participate, and pretty much everybody said yes. There was one interesting story that Michael Kidd, the great choreographer director who choreographed Guys and Dolls, among other shows, he agreed to an interview, and we did the whole interview, and then he said, well, I want to get paid. And we said, well, we're sorry, Mr. Kidd, for public television, we're prohibited from paying any of our interviews, because essentially then we'd be paying you to say what we want,
right?
And that's not how public television works. And he looked around the room. He said, well, you're getting paid, right? And I said, yeah, we're getting paid. Not much, but we do get paid to come out to California and interview you. And he said, well, if you get paid, I should get paid. And ultimately, I wrote him a letter, and I said, I can't pay you per PBS rules. So we're faced with this kind of choice. Either you let us use the interview that we recorded in the series, or we're going to have to get somebody else, like some other choreographer, Tommy Toon, or someone else to speak about your role in that history, because you're so important. We're not going to skip over you, but it's either a choice of you telling your story or someone else telling it. And sure enough, everyone would much prefer to tell their own story, and he agreed to let us use the material. So that was the closest time when someone we really wanted to tell the story was kind of didn't want to participate.
And how long would you spend with these people in terms of, say, filming them or shooting them?
We take as much time as they'd give. Generally, people start to fade after about 2 hours. You know, most interviews run about 90 minutes. And after about 2 hours, you can just tell the energy's low. So if you really need somebody, the best thing to do is to do an interview and tell them that they're so essential, so important, that later in the process, a year later or what have you, you want to come back and cover some other ground. So we did that with Hal Prince. We did that with Al Hirschfeld. We only got one shot at Sondheim. But whenever we could, we would return to people. There was actually a fellow, an academic writer named Phil Furia, who wrote about lyricists and was particularly good on Ira Gershwin and others, and we actually interviewed him twice.
Now, Julie Andrews writes the foreword to this third edition. Was she always the first choice for the narrator of the film?
Yes. I met with... I corresponded with Julie Andrews' people, so to speak, very early on when I was starting the project. And she had a competing project. She was developing a program called Front Row Center with then Al Hirschfeld's wife, Louise Hirschfeld. And I said, okay, well, you know, I think as far as I can remember, hers was a bit more entertainment-oriented, and ours was kind of more historical, contextual. And I said, okay, great. You know, hopefully I'm always the more the merrier. Mm-hmm. You know, if you like Broadway, do your thing. Anyway, a few years later, the series took about 9 years to make. We reached out and we showed her the material, and she was happy to join in, and it was a joy working with her. I'll share one little joke about the fact that it took nine years, which is that the opening of the series and the book was held at the Schubert Theater on 44th Street. And Mayor Mike Bloomberg was there, and Julie came in, and it was a great celebration. And my nine-year-old daughter turned to me and said, "Dad, you know, I'm the most important person who will ever see this documentary." And, you know, it had taken 9 years to make. And I said, why, Emma? Why are you the most important person? She said, well, I've waited my whole life for it. So she said that night, and I vividly remember introducing her to Julie Andrews and sharing that joke. And anyway, I just can't say enough about how professional Julie is. She doesn't flub her lines. She hits her marks. And when it came to reading the narration and contributing good ideas, one day she was beset with a kind of a migraine, and she just, you know, she fought through it. She's like literally a trooper. She wants to make it work, and I'm ever grateful that she helped kind of raise the bar for us.
Now, you're the executive producer of American Masters on PBS, and thinking about that role, and then, of course, the role of the filmmaker for Broadway, the American musical, for a lot of people, your work is the first glimpse that they have of whatever it's about. So if it's about Broadway, they'll probably see the film or read the book before they'll get to Broadway, even to watch a show.
That's true.
Does that... does that place a sort of responsibility on your role as a producer, say, as a filmmaker, as an author?
Well, that's the nice part about being part of public television and having a partner, Lawrence Maslin, who teaches at NYU, is that unlike a Broadway show itself, where there's a risk that, you know, somebody's going to miss an entrance or sneeze at the wrong moment by mistake or what have you. With a documentary film or with a book, you really get a chance to vet things, to share them with other experts, to make sure that, you know, everything's correct and historically accurate and so on. So I don't think you find the worry at the end. I think the worry is up front.
Mm-hmm.
The worry is raising enough money so that you can license things, and whether it's a still photo for the book or a clip of, you know, Joel Grey in Cabaret or what have you. Because you know deep down, if you don't raise enough money and put together a good distribution plan for it, that your work as a documentary filmmaker is going to be limited, and that's going to impact what you're sharing with people, and you won't be proud of it. So that's why this series took 9 years to make. And, you know, I made another documentary called Broadway Musicals, A Jewish Legacy,
mm-hmm.
which doesn't have a companion book, but it's been very successful on PBS and elsewhere in terms of reaching an audience. And that was because a woman came to me and said, you know, in Broadway, the American musical, you don't really look at this phenomenon that at a given point in time, so many of the songwriters, the composers and lyricists were Jewish. The performers were all different ethnicities and races and so forth. But the songwriters of the musical from the 20s to, say, through the 50s were, with few exceptions, Cole Porter, Vincent Eumanns, a couple of others, were Jewish. And
mm-hmm.
I said, well, the first question is, it's like the old joke, you know, which comes first, the song or the lyrics, the music or the lyrics, and Comden and Green would say, the check. So with regard to this other documentary, I told the lady, well, listen, it's a great story, but if you can't raise the money for it, get involved. And thankfully she did, and so that was kind of a supplement or a complement to this six-part series, which was looking at a particular aspect of the musical, which of course has so many different, you know, whether it's stage design and performance and songwriting, that looked just at the songwriters in an interesting way.
So another role that you have is you still are a Tony voter, is that right?
I'm both executive producer of the American Masters series, uh-huh. which presents 10 to 12 new films a year on people who've changed American culture.
Uh-huh.
And so, for instance, earlier this week we had a new film on Miles Davis, jazz great. And upcoming, we're doing a film on Rita Moreno, who is incredible, speaking of EGOT winner,
mm-hmm.
Emmy, Grammy, Oscar, and Tony. But yes, I'm in the third and final year as a Tony nominator. There are Tony nominators and Tony voters.
I see.
And Tony voters, there's a much bigger pool, and they don't get to vote on the nominations. They just get to vote on who wins the award. And we vote on who's going to be nominated, and part of that is seeing every Broadway show with the original cast. Carefully noting what you like and what you don't like, and coming together as a group to cast these secret votes. And we don't know until it's announced publicly who's been nominated, but it's been a wonderful experience.
I was going to ask about the experience of doing that, because, I mean, you have to see everything. Does it tire you at all?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's you know, I think most great experiences aren't, you know, if you have the greatest meal you've ever had, you're going to feel full.
Mm.
And, you know, a great trip to somewhere across the world, it's hard to get there. I think there's an aspect of that, especially in April when shows are backed up, you know, what everyone wants to open in April, because then if they get nominated, they get that kind of commercial boost.
Right.
And so you might see three or four Broadway shows in a week. Sometimes on a weekend you'll see three or four. You'll see, you know, matinee and an evening show and so on. But for people who love the theater, that's just, you know, that's just a four-course meal.
Yeah.
To continue that analogy, it's never burdensome. I mean, there are people who've been Tony nominators who live in other cities and come in to see all the shows and travel. So, for me, again, it's just a joy.
Do you see yourself, say, 5 years from now, updating this book again?
I don't know. I think, you know, you can never predict what's going to happen. We've updated it twice since 2004, so that would be every 7.5 years, so to speak, if you average it. It feels about the right amount of time. You know, the part of the problem is you can't make the book 1,000 pages,
right.
So you have to figure out little things you can trim or you can change the size and so on. But I think the Broadway musical keeps evolving, and as long as it keeps introducing new talents and new styles and new content, we want to chart that.
And you are optimistic about its future, right? It's not going away anytime soon, is it?
I'm very optimistic. I think there's been so many interesting crossovers. The phenomenon of Hamilton pushed the Broadway musical back onto the music charts in a way that it hadn't been there for some time. But when you look at the cyclical nature of say, clothing, you know,
yeah,
bell bottoms or, you know, halter tops or whatever it is, things come into fashion and then go away, and then 10, 20 years later, they're back. And seeing the producers, the kind of classic music comedy come back was really fun and joyful. And now we're in, you know, an era where a lot of movies are being adapted, but I just think it keeps evolving. In fact, the most interesting thing I discovered while working on the documentary and working on the book was that the biggest groundbreaking shows of all time are always the most experimental, whether it's Oklahoma or Chorus Line. And look at the movie that won this year, Parasite, at the Oscars. It's those risky sort of let's break the rules and try something shows that inevitably become the landmarks. And you can't predict them because they are by nature experimental or out of the box. So I think that's going to keep happening. And, you know, the theaters are landmarked, so they're not going to be torn down or destroyed. And I think that the model may change a little bit, but you know, I just moved back to New York City proper from, I like to joke, as George M. Cohan said, I was 45 minutes from Broadway. That was one of his big songs. And I'm back in the city. And, you know, every day, if you walk around Times Square, which has now been made much more pedestrian-friendly, you know, there are fewer cars that can zip through, and you walk on 44th Street or 47th Street or what have you, it's crowded around theater time. People want to see these shows when they come to New York from either near, as I was, 45 minutes away, or far.
Yeah.
They want to grab that live, you know, theater opportunity, and there's just nothing like it.
Indeed, indeed. And there's nothing like this book, and it's just delightful to reread it again, have the chance to reread it again, and then, of course, read the update to it. Kept you longer than I said. I could talk all day with you. This has been delightful. Congratulations on the book and the film.
Again, for your listeners, the third edition of Broadway, the American Musical, goes right up through the 2018-2019 season, which culminated in the Tony Award for Hadestown.
Right.
And features Lin-Manuel Miranda on the cover. The cover itself has evolved over the three editions. And so if you really want to be kind of up to speed on both where the Broadway musical has been and what it's doing now, I can't recommend it enough.
Thanks for this, Michael.
Oh, thank you.
The book, Broadway, the American Musical, third edition, is published by Applause Books. One of its authors, Michael Cantor, joined me on the line from New York City. in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plantum.